Welcome back to our Prostate Cancer Think Tank. The next controversy addressed was the role of post-prostatectomy radiation therapy in high-risk patients, and Dr. Crawford led the discussion.
Adjuvant therapy, there are pros and cons. The pros are better biochemical control. Maybe you're treating more patients than you need to. Better local control. Lower doses potentially could be used. You're treating smaller tumors. We know smaller is better. The cons are no survival benefit. You're treating many patients that don't need to be treated. If they have metastatic disease, there's no benefit. Increased cost, treating more patients, and risk of unnecessary toxicity. Salvage. Pros and cons are a little bit different, but the pros are you're only treating those that are failing. It's more cost-effective. The cons are you may be delaying therapy when they're not curable. They have metastatic disease. No benefits with METs, and you're treating larger tumors and maybe less responsive.
I want to begin with Steve. In view of your comments about your approach to androgen deprivation, how do you approach the issue of consideration of post-prostatectomy radiation therapy?
If you look at the data that was published in Lancet from the, I think it was EROTC study, that looked at men with positive margins, for example, treated with adjuvant radiation, about 50% of patients with positive margins not treated with adjuvant radiation had a PSA recurrence. 50% did not. When given adjuvant radiation, about 70% of men did not have a PSA recurrence. So bumped it from 50 to 70%, i.e. of the 50% that needed it, about 40% were delayed because of adjuvant radiation. And then you take that and look at the Stevenson data, and again, you're taking one study and another study and trying to make sense out of the two studies. But in Stevenson data, it was about a 45 to 50% of men did not have a PSA recurrence among a select group of men who were eligible for salvage radiation. So I think putting the two together makes, at least in my mind, again, my biased view of reading the literature, that it's a very good argument, those two studies collectively, for salvage radiation. You're not treating the men who don't need it, and the men that do need it, you're able to provide them as almost an equally efficacious therapy at the time of recurrence.
Mike?
I think the SWOG data is certainly important, but it doesn't yet show us that if we followed patients carefully upon a detectable and bona fide rise of a PSA, we can do the same in terms of disease-free survival benefit. So I think the interesting thing about the SWOG data is that there was a crossover of patients, as you had mentioned, and it perhaps shows that earlier administration of the therapy versus later is going to benefit patients. So what I take from this, and this has been our practice, is that in general, even for a positive margin patient, we would discuss the option with patients for adjuvant versus salvage, but more often than not, we would recommend salvage upon manifestation of a detectable and rising PSA.
Jerry and then Len.
David, I'm missing something here. The 15-year data shows no survival advantage, yet you see a very dramatic difference in PSA recurrence. The only conclusion I get from that one is PSA recurrence means nothing.
Well,
I mean,
maybe
15, you're gonna need 20 years to see this difference
in survival? I think this refutes what you just said earlier. It shows the value of early hormonal therapy because these people that fail see the failures in the early hormone therapy. So you're delaying hormone therapy, but hormone therapy is effective in the long run too.
So it's kind of an equalizer.
So yeah. You're saying they either get radiation or hormones, but either way, that has a benefit, essentially.
To me, it doesn't argue that the radiation is helping a whole lot then.
I agree with Michael because my practice usually is, unlike Camilla's, who radiates anybody that he operates on, is that I believe in waiting until somebody has a failure. And if they have a failure, you get them early. And I think that the ASTRO consensus group said there's no evidence that waiting in general until they have a PSA of 0.8, 0.4, whatever, that you might have equal outcomes. I think the SWOG study, the whole thing behind this is these studies in early prostate cancer are long-term commitments. And so what if it's 17 years and we show a survival benefit and we've kept people off of hormone therapy? I think that may be important.
Len?
I was about to compliment Dr. Crawford, but I've changed my mind. Dr. Crawford for years has been critical of our interest at Jefferson in postoperative radiation therapy, and he's made no bones about it, so I'm pleased to see that he's finally seen the light. The other thing is, I think with postoperative radiation therapy, you have to remember a couple of things that people like to throw around that may or may not be true. Number one, you don't radiate everybody. You radiate people at high risk for recurrence, and you run a nomogram or you do a the new Orion test, if you believe that that's going to have some weight. You figure out who's at risk for progression, and then you go ahead and you offer them the radiation therapy. That's the first thing. The second thing is there's a lot of subtleties in how the radiation oncologists deliver radiation therapy in the post-prostatectomy setting, and maybe Dr. Zalewski can comment on that. There are very cautious radiation oncologists who completely change how they administer their radiation therapy in the post-radical prostatectomy setting. The last thing is the dose is very important, and I suggest that in current standards, Dr. Crawford's dose in his study is far lower than is used today, and that had a higher dose been used, if people would have been able to give her a higher dose with less side effects, the results might have been much more pronounced than we're seeing in his study.
I want Mike to comment about the issue of morbidity in this situation, but before he does, Lenny, can you describe a typical patient who you would use post-op radiation therapy and a typical patient who you would not?
What we have come to do is we rely heavily on the Catan nomograms, and we'll run a nomogram on a patient, and our general approach is that they have less than a 25% recurrence after radical prostatectomy based on their postoperative features. We mention it to them, but we don't usually recommend it. The patients above 50% at the present time at our center, we strongly recommend that they consider adjuvant radiation therapy within 3 to 6 months of the radical prostatectomy. And those who hit somewhere in between, we offer it as an option and kind of let the patient decide. I mean, ultimately, the patient decides across the board, but we really strongly encourage the greater than 50% recurrence rates to think about radiation.
Can you comment, Mike, on the issue of morbidity?
Certainly in the shorter term or even in the mid-range post-treatment, we see exacerbation of stress incontinence, and there are increased number of bladder neck strictures down the road, and there's an increased risk for proctitis, although the risks of serious injuries, you know, with proper techniques remain low. But I think it's important or incumbent upon anybody discussing post-op radiation or a salvage radiotherapy with the patient to indicate that the morbidity will be increased above and beyond radical prostatectomy. We are increasing potential complications, albeit small. As far as the issue that Len brought up regarding the dose, right now, retrospective series, the one from Valicenti, suggests that higher radiation doses are needed. I don't think we have any prospective trials that have really clarified that, but currently the standard doses in the community about 65 to 70 gray. Now, whether higher doses would actually be better, that's unclear, but certainly that would increase morbidity. I think we're not seeing long-term morbidity because of those studies. They've used lower radiation doses, and basically you're not harming them.
Tom?
I get back to Steve's point. If you wait until the PSA starts to rise, are you going to do the patient a disservice? Is the disease going to have any poorer outcome? To my knowledge, has there ever been a head-to-head comparison of immediate versus delayed radiation therapy? And just waiting until that PSA gets to a point, I mean, we know the lower the PSA, the better you do. But it started out at 2, then it went to 1.5, now it's gone to below 1. And, you know, we can all see the trend coming up. The difficulty is the ASTRO criteria for radiation failure. If you're going to believe them, you may miss a significant window where you can be affecting these differences. But I've never seen a head-to-head comparison, to my knowledge, prospective, where they looked at adjuvant versus salvage. And by using salvage, you can save a lot of patients some of these problems, which Mike very clearly points out. They're going higher and higher on the doses. I mean, now you're going to 70 gray. Well, that's the old treatment for full-blown radiation with your prostate still in place. What's going to happen there?
Tom, I think you have to think about the patient's standpoint. And Dave Crawford has studied this before. A rising PSA in a patient who's been treated for definitive local therapy is devastating on their overall quality of life.
It's only going to 0.2. In fact, most of the people now who will turn around and say, I hate supersensitive assays. I'm certainly becoming disenchanted with them because I spend quite a lot of time on the phone where I'm looking at 0.01, 0.03, back to 0.01, up to 0.05. I don't know what to make of them. So if you use 0.2 as your sign of failure and you're considering giving radiation therapy, post-surgery, if you're at 0.2, you probably need something done if you're a person who believes in doing something. So I don't think that argument plays into it at all.
Laurie and then Craig.
2 points. One is there was a presentation at ASCO by a multi-centered group, which I believe D'Amico was the senior author, that showed that response to salvage radiation improved according to the PSA and was best when the PSA was below 0.2. So that curve of response to PSA at the time of treatment has now been pushed to the point where it's almost undetectable. And I think what makes sense is it's clear that patients do better the earlier they're treated if they need treatment. So pick the ones who you are almost certain are going to progress and treat them because there's no point waiting. And then the rest, I think it's reasonable to take the small risk and wait. I just want to respond to Jerry's comment about PSA. that it's meaningless as a PSA recurrence. If the neoadjuvant hormonal therapy trials had showed a difference in PSA progression, we would today be having a discussion about what the optimal duration and what the patient selection criteria for neoadjuvant hormones prior to surgery was. No one would dispute that PSA progression in that setting was not meaningful. And I think you have to give the same benefit of the doubt to the adjuvant radiation trials.
You got 15 years of no difference in survival. And PSA differences that occurred really early.
Paul? To me, the big downfall of the neoadjuvant androgen deprivation trials was the translation of positive margins to PSA benefit, and it never did translate, and the trials were considered unsuccessful. However, here we have an adjuvant therapy that does translate into a PSA benefit, and I mirror what Laurie said. I think that it's interesting how one modality, I think, would have been accepted with a great deal of reasonable enthusiasm, where the other is ignored to some degree. And so we've said it a few times, we seem to speak to different issues with different enthusiasm depending upon mindset.
Okay, Steve and then Dave.
Just a really quick comment. Laurie, that ASCO abstract you referred to, it was data from CAPTURE. And what they did show is that treating with what they called salvage radiation with a PSA of 0.3 or lower had a benefit, but they didn't define a lower limit. So a lot of those guys were treated with PSAs at 0.01, 0.02 that we would probably consider adjuvant in that setting anyway. So it's a mixed bag.
But
in general, I do agree with the concept that most of the data from Stevenson and others showing earlier for the salvage is better, but specifically that one abstract I think was hard to get that out of that
one. But even in that abstract, it was the lowest PSA cohort that had the best response.
Right, though it included a lot of adjuvant that probably didn't need treatment anyway. But in general, yes, I agree.
I think we have to look at what's been learned with radiation and other tumors, head and neck, colorectal, rectal, things like that. Michael, you chime in about the benefit of doing it in an adjuvant setting. The second thing is perhaps, if you look at the paper we have coming out about the long-term complications and quality of life, Carol Moyenpoor's paper, maybe related to the fact that we had a lower dose of radiation. I don't know. And the third thing is to comment on Schellhammer's comments about neoadjuvant studies, which are all been negative from Soloway's to DeBrine's to others. Give them time. It's going to take a long time to see a benefit, and I bet the same thing's going to happen.
Dr. Mario Eisenberger tackled the next question, the implementation of large clinical trials to evaluate chemotherapy in patients at high risk for recurrence.
In terms of adjuvant treatment, we obviously have, based on the risk, many candidates. We have effective treatment, both hormonal therapy and systemic chemotherapy. And I would obviously suggest that the benefit from adjuvant treatment or from early treatment will be a lot more consequential than the benefit that we get in patients with metastatic disease. There are several questions, several different ways of addressing adjuvant treatment, neoadjuvant, concomitant chemo and radiation therapy, for instance. We prefer the postoperative setting. I think it provides for an adequate staging at this point. It allows you a good criteria for selecting those patients that are risky, to find the risks, and it facilitates in sort of a more or less quantifiable way the assessments of risk so you can design your study. You can determine your sample size, your duration of study, etc. And I would even submit that the postoperative adjuvant setting probably has better patient and physician acceptance than if you, for instance, look at it in a neoadjuvant setting. Adjuvant chemotherapy is standard in breast, colorectal cancer, and even one can argue about this being the case in lung cancer and in prostate cancer, despite the fact that we have effective treatment. We don't know that yet. SWOG 9921 is a study in which patients with high risk following radical prostatectomy are randomized to receive immediate hormonal therapy for 2 years versus immediate hormonal therapy plus 6 months of mitoxantrone and prednisone. This study started in 1999, so it was prior to the taxane era, was considered the adjuvant chemotherapy or the chemotherapy available at that time. Study's having some trouble, but I think I'm told that maybe 900 patients have been entered. I hope they will complete. the issue does not have a no treatment control arm, which is very difficult to do, but let's hope this study will complete. About 3 years ago, we did a pilot study, which is now being reported by Adam Kaibo, and we looked at the window of radical prostatectomy to PSA relapse, and essentially was a feasibility study. Patients essentially got, if the pathology was reviewed centrally at Johns Hopkins by Jonathan Epstein, then we looked at our R sub W, a model which separates patients according to their probability of relapse. We had about 9 institutions participating on this, and this is just a pure feasibility study. This was done before TAX-327 came out. That's why we chose the weekly Taxotere data. And we found that toxicities were as expected. 76 out of 77 patients completed. And this is a study in which patients who have no more than a 60% probability of remaining disease-free at 5 years by Mikitan's nomogram, they're randomized between initial observation or treatment. And the treatment on both the observation, which is treated at time of progression, involves 18 months of leuprolide or 18 months of leuprolide plus Taxotere. And all these patients here require a non-measurable PSA, an undetectable PSA, prior to randomization. And essentially, what this trial here tests is a hypothesis. And essentially, if we consider that early treatment could be more effective than deferred treatment because it tumor burden is smaller, then I think we can say that the immediate treatment will push. If we consider this a threshold where clinical disease is apparent, with immediate treatment, we'll be able to push the disease burden below that threshold compared to deferred treatment. And if you consider a heterogeneity in the biological behavior of prostate cancer cells with regard to hormone sensitivity, one would also expect that the arm with immediate hormonal therapy and chemotherapy could be potentially the best arm, which could more effectively push the entire disease below that threshold, where it may not come out in the future or in the period where you're observing the trial.
Dr. Howard Scheer led the discussion concerning trials of adjuvant chemotherapy.
I'm not sure that the R sub W demonstration of a delay in progression on a small number of patients is sufficient to justify a 2,000-patient trial. And there's still open questions about chemotherapy alone, chemotherapy plus hormones, hormones alone, optimal timing, optimal sequence. And given that these trials are very long, require enormous resources, and again, the track record of accrual in this setting in the urologic community remains poor, I think we have to have very convincing data before we start these studies. And I'm not sure that we've shown that yet.
Dan, what are your thoughts on that?
I think that we need to complete the studies. I mean, I think we need to complete 9921 because if we keep on shifting our chemotherapy every time, we're never going to be able to complete a randomized trial. Every time there'll be some new chemotherapy coming about. And, you know, the fact is that we're very, very close to getting the mitoxantrone study done. And I think that we have competing trials, and I think that these are important to do sequentially.
Dave?
I would agree. We need to complete these trials, and I think these are one of the most important trials ongoing. Again, we're 20 years behind other tumors because of this. Regarding 9921, the SWOG study, Taxotere was around when we designed that. We knew about it, but we thought we should kind of go gently into chemotherapy with something which was well-tolerated when we did this. There's other tumors where using less aggressive chemotherapy, even things like mitoxantrone, work. So that study has almost 1,000 patients on it. It will be completed. I think the downside of this that I agree with Mario is we don't have a control arm. Len?
One of the issues that we have to face here as we talk about evidence-based medicine and randomized clinical trials is that there's actually a decreasing pool of these high-risk patients. And we have to recognize the classically described high-risk patient in all data sets is becoming less and less and less frequent. Our ability to accrue patients to trials is really starting to be compromised for a couple of reasons. One of the first reasons is this pool of high-risk patients is going away, clearly shown in all databases. The other thing that's happening is there is increasing competition for this limited pool. You look at Mario's great study, he's got over 200 sites, but 80 in the United States, most of those are international sites. Our ability here in the United States to really draw from a pool of patients is becoming limited. Plus, the drug manufacturers themselves are aggressively going after the same pool of patients. patients for their trials, as are the intergroups like RTOG, SWOG, CALGB. So whoever has the pulpit at the time and talking about the trial, like when Dave talks about SWOG trials, they're the most important trials when Dave gets there and talk. A CALG person supports their most important trials. So I think as we go forward with this limited pool of patients at a more global level, we're going to have to address which are the highest priority trials in some fashion in order to make sure that those trials meet recruitment in a reasonable amount of time and don't drag on for years and years and
years. Okay, so how do you...
Tom?
I'm not sure, Lenny, that the pool of high-risk patients is necessarily reducing. I think we don't see as many with lymph node positivity, but I think we see a large number of patients with high risk of progressing to locally advanced disease, which doesn't mean that that pool is lessening. We're just seeing them earlier on. Everybody's not getting 3+3. I mean, we're still seeing 4s, we're still seeing 5s, and we're seeing them in the younger patients. So my feeling is they're at higher risk for developing locally advanced or metastatic. They may not be there yet.
Let the record
still
state
there.
My words were the traditionally defined high-risk patient, which Howard alluded to earlier. I don't know if the risk stratification we have right now, it's fantastic, it's great, but there's a lot of subtleties, particularly intermediate risk, we're missing. If you look at the traditionally defined group, CAPSURE, CPDR, sure, everybody, that percent has gone from about 30-something percent in the early 90s down to about 17% in the early 2000s. So that traditionally defined group is going away.
But this new high-risk group may actually be the ones that we will really see the benefit in, because we may be able to deal with them.
Fair enough, but all our trials are defined on the traditional so-called D'Amico risk stratification, which I think is going to require more analysis as time goes on.
Yeah, fair enough.
Steve, then Howard, then Paul.
Well, that was kind of my follow-up to that. I mean, the D'Amico came out in 1998, so it's 8 years ago. We've identified now tumor biopsy volume. I mean, 12 out of 12 course positive of Gleason 6, to me, is not low risk, despite a Gleason 6. A microfocus of Gleason 7 may not be an intermediate risk. And also PSA kinetics, the PSA rise greater than 2 nanograms per mil in the year prior to diagnosis. Clearly, I mean, D'Amico, I've seen him present now, is putting those patients as high risk despite other low risk features. Is it time for these trials that we reanalyze how we define intermediate and high risk? That's not being done.
Howard?
I agree. When you sit with a patient, you have to say, what is the risk of you developing some event? It could be PSA recurrence, it could be local recurrence, it could be metastatic progression or death. That's what's going to factor into that patient's decision to, one, accept therapy, and then you can get into the potential relative benefits of the therapy regarding each of those endpoints. I don't think we have good enough models, or they're, for lack of a better term, too loosey-goosey. There's too much heterogeneity in those risk definitions. And that's part of the reason that patients aren't accepting the trials. The questions are good ones. And using chemotherapy, I think, is appropriate in the right setting. But until you can have that discussion with a patient for his cancer, accrual is going to stay low.
Paul, and then Craig.
The comment with regard to accrual and acceptance, I found it interesting with regard to 3501, Mario, that the surveillance arm, although I think it's scientifically solid, is a detriment because patients, when told they have high-risk disease, are not inclined then to be randomized to a no-treatment arm. And I'm sure you thought about that, but we have been relatively unsuccessful in accrual. And the other question is with regard to external beam, just your philosophy about making that a non-eligibility criteria post-RP.
You know, Paul, that's been a major issue because the data with radiation came in a little later. Well, first, let me comment. I think that we need to start out with no treatment. I mean, just the way the breast cancer and all the other diseases, the way the adjuvant question was addressed, you need to start with a no treatment control arm. I don't think we're ready to assume that because they have high-risk disease, they should be treated. It may be difficult to do, but I think we need to try. As far as the adjuvant therapy with radiation, it's a big question. When we looked in our pilot, we found that the median time to progression on that patient population is about 10 months. So we're talking about patients with a Gleason 8 plus seminal vascular involvement, positive margins by high Gleason score, some with positive nodes. It's hard for me to believe that in that subset of patients, a local treatment is likely to make a big impact on the natural history of the disease. So I think that very likely these are going to be the patients that are going to enter in 3501. If I were to start 3501 today, I would probably incorporate radiation therapy because it would be the smart thing to do from an ethical point of view, I don't think it's a problem, because I do know that patients that are candidates for local therapy, Gleason 7, positive margins, everything else negative, are likely not to make it on that clinical trial. We also modeled it, how many of the patient population will actually not make it because of the new radiation data, and I did that with MyCatan. It was only about 11% of the patients, so I elected not to modify the protocol at this time, but I think we might have to do it if accrual is poor in 1 or 2 years. And we polled people all over the world and see how actually radiation therapy changed your practice in the subset of patients we enter here. And we didn't get a very negative response to it. So we'll see what happens. I think we need to do a clinical trial in adjuvant studies. I think 9921 was designed a long time ago. It was a reasonable study at that time. I'm a little more concerned about it now. There's no treatment control arm. It uses a chemotherapy that is primarily palliative. So I think that will affect the accrual. I hope it finishes. I would support it. If I had it active in my institution, I would put my patients on it. I think that we have more patients now globally because the shift is such and everybody gets treated that we're going to see more patients that are candidates. We just have to get started.